Well, turn with me this morning to Genesis chapter 30. Genesis chapter 30. We are resuming our studies of the historical record regarding the unfolding of God's redemptive plan. Now, in our last study, we completed chapter 29, where we read about Jacob's meeting Rachel and the 7 years of servitude to her father Laban that her hand in marriage would cost him. The trouble with that was that Laban had another trick up his sleeve, which would cost Jacob another 7 years, and that was, unbeknownst to Jacob, Laban actually placed Leah in Jacob's tent, so he thought he was going in on his wedding night to Rachel, but it turned out to be Leah, and again, that cost him another 7 years of servitude. In the remainder of chapter 29 through verse 24 of chapter 30, we learn about the birth of Jacob's 12 sons, as well as a daughter named Dinah. You might be wondering why I didn't say anything about Dinah in our last study. This is because we'll actually learn more about her and her own circumstantial role in redemptive history when we get to chapter 34. So you can be looking for that. Speaking of Jacob's 12 sons, it's important once again to remember that these 12 sons were actually born of four different women with Leah. Jacob fathered sons 1 through 4. That would be Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, as well as sons 9 and 10, which would be Issachar and Zebulun. With Rachel's maid Bilhah, he fathered sons 5 and 6, which were Dan and Naphtali. With Leah's maid Zilpah came sons 7 and 8, Gad and Asher. And with Rachel, he fathered sons 11 and 12, Joseph and Benjamin, who won't arrive until chapter 35. As I pointed out last time, we are going to learn a lot more about each of these sons. That's why I didn't take the time as they're born to explain more about their lives. You're going to see these sons throughout the remainder of our Old Testament studies, and we're going to learn a great deal about them. Were they perfect sons? No. Were they deserving of being distinguished as the 12 patriarchs of Israel? No. No. And that's just the thing, isn't it? God doesn't take the most deserving and use them. He takes the most undeserving, the most unlikely people imaginable, and uses them to His own ends. We can see that going on even in our text this morning. Read with me, beginning at verse 25. Of this 30th chapter. Moses writes, "Now it came about when Rachel had borne Joseph that Jacob said to Laban, 'Send me away that I may go to my own place and my own country. Give me my wives and my children for whom I have served you, and let me depart, for you yourself know my service which I have rendered you. Jacob's time has been served faithfully, and he's ready to return to the home he had left 14 years earlier.' But Laban said to him, 'If now it pleases you, stay with me. I have divined that the Lord has blessed me on your account.' He continued, 'Name me your wages, and I will give it.'" You know, this is actually Laban's way of saying to Jacob, "Look, since your arrival, it's undeniable that the Lord has blessed me greatly. Now, what will it take to get you to stay?" Now, this sounds like an endearing proposition. It sounds like Laban has finally come to his senses. He's finally come to respect Jacob, at least in a little way. He's finally reasoned that the only way he'll ever prosper is to have someone like Jacob around. Jacob has proven himself to be very faithful, very diligent, a man of his word in most cases. And so Laban seems to be approaching Jacob from at least some point of endearment here. Is that the case? No, Laban is still Laban. Laban still has only one person in mind as the most important person in the universe. And who's that? Laban, right? So don't get the idea that he's being really nice to Jacob here. Laban's simply wanting more of what Jacob was already able to provide for him in terms of wealth. So he, once again, calls upon Jacob to name his own price, perhaps thinking that, as before, Jacob would not take advantage of him and cost him too dearly. He had already been able once to get over on Jacob. Remember what we said about Jacob's 7 years of servitude? It was Jacob who established that time frame really as an initial offer, thinking that Laban would come back and say, no, that's slave labor. You know, how about you work for me for 3 years? But, you know, Laban didn't do that. He says, 7 years, sold. And then, to add insult to injury, when he insisted that Jacob take Leah's hand also in marriage, he said, oh, and it's going to cost you another 7 years. He repeated the same sinful, greedy stipulation. But here's the thing. Jacob is fairly smart at this point. Jacob's already fallen for Laban's deception once, so now it's his turn to set the record straight relative to who should actually be calling the shots. Jacob says to Laban in verses 29 and 30, you yourself know how I have served you and how your cattle have fared with me, for you had little before I came, and it has increased to a multitude, and the Lord has blessed you wherever I turn. But now, when shall I provide for my own household also? Now, just to be clear, Jacob's not insinuating that Laban had been impoverished when he arrived. He wasn't saying that Laban was poor when Jacob arrived. He was simply saying that Laban was in a much better financial position now that he had been there for 14 years than he ever could have hoped to have been on his own. Laban was probably somewhere what we would classify as middle class. Now, though, he's part of the upper crust. He's part of the rich and famous, as it were, as a result of what Jacob had been able to do. So, again, Jacob's not insisting that Laban was in poverty. He's just wanting him to respect the fact that everything Laban had was a result of Jacob's hard work. Put it simply, Jacob's saying, listen up, Laban, I've made you rich. Now it's time for me to provide for my own family. And once again, in verse 31, Laban asks, no doubt with a little less greed and deception in mind, he probably senses that Jacob is on to him. He says, what shall I give you? Now notice the terms have changed. It's not how can I entice you particularly, it's what can I give you? And you know, we all like gifts. We all like being given things, especially in exchange for services rendered. And so Jacob might have said, well, I want you to give me everything that I've earned for you, and then I'll be on my way. But he doesn't say that, does he? What does he say? He says, you shall not give me anything. If you will do this one thing for me, I will again pasture and keep your flock. And what's the one thing that Jacob wants from Laban? Verse 32. Jacob says, let me pass through your entire flock today, removing from there every speckled and spotted sheep and every black one among the lambs and the spotted and speckled among the goats, and such shall be my wages. Jacob then sweetens the deal with a pledge of his own honesty. He says, so my honesty will answer for me later when you come concerning my wages. Everyone that is not speckled and spotted among the goats and black among the lambs, if found with me, will be considered stolen. Now it's really important that we slow down and understand exactly what's going on here. It seems as though Jacob's making a proposal that would yet again benefit Laban more than himself. But remember, Jacob has already proven himself to be an absolute genius in the area of animal husbandry. Jacob knows sheep. Jacob knows goats. He has been a shepherd most of his life. He has raised them. He has bred them. He has interbred them. He knows a thing or two about what he's saying here. And he had a few tricks of his own up his sleeve. Or at least he thought he did. In Jacob's day, sheeps, lambs, and goats that were anything but pure white or brown were considered not to be worthless, but they were considered to be of lesser value. Why? Because, as you well know, they made things from the wool of lambs and from the hair of goats. They would make things like tarps. They would make clothing. They would make all kinds of rugs, all kinds of things out of the wool that was shaved off of their sheep. And it was an inexhaustible resource. So you could keep doing that over and over and over as long as the animal remained alive. The speckled and spotted animals, they were good for really only two things. They were good for milk, and they were good for meat. Now, that doesn't render them worthless. Again, it renders them of less value because they can't be used in the other more lucrative ways that the pure white and the pure brown animals could be used. But see, Jacob is a capitalist. Jacob understands that although individually these animals might be of lesser value, he knew that the more of them that he could accumulate, the richer he could become. It's all about volume in Jacob's mind. And we can see that as this thing begins to unfold. Now, one would think that Jacob would have made a deal with Laban in which Jacob would have taken all the pure, single-colored animals and left Laban with these less valuable and less desirable spotted and striped animals. But instead, he agrees to take the quote-unquote defective ones. And not only that, he doubles down and he tells Laban, "Laban, you can check me out. Check my flock out as long and as often as you desire. And if you find any single-colored animals in my flock, you can consider them stolen." Which means that Laban would have been able to take them back to his own pure flock and breed them as he wished. He would have also been able to extract a fine from Jacob, probably a really exorbitant fine from Jacob for having stolen or been in possession of animals that should not have been in his own flock. Seems like a good deal for Laban, doesn't it? So what does Laban do? Well, Laban really doesn't trust his son-in-law, obviously, because instead of simply taking Jacob at his word, Laban begins culling this flock himself, verses 34 through 36. Laban said, "Good, let it be according to your word." So he removed on that day the striped and spotted male goats and all the speckled and spotted female goats, everyone with white in it and all the black ones among the sheep, and he gave them into the care of his sons. And he put a distance of 3 days' journey between himself and Jacob, and Jacob fed the rest of Laban's flocks. So what do we have here? What's the picture in our mind? We've got two flocks, right? We've got Laban's flock, which contains all of the pure colored animals, the whites and the browns. We've got Jacob's flock that's under the care of Laban's sons, moved 3 days' distance away, and that's all of your stripe and spotted animals. Okay, you got the picture in your head, right? What's Jacob doing at this point? He's simply watching Laban's sheep. He said, "You've given me this one flock of all the striped and spotted animals, and that's good enough. I'm going to now, according to my agreement, I'm going to watch your flock and take care of them." So, again, Laban's left with all the preferred stock, and Jacob's flock is the spotted and striped. As one commentator noted here, Laban thinks that Jacob's strategy is going to be to interbreed those speckled and spotted mongrel animals with his pure animals in order to make more speckled and spotted animals. That's why he moved them so far away. He's like, I see what you're probably going to do. You're going to put these flocks close together, and what you're going to do, you're going to breed some of yours with some of mine, so that every speckled or spotted animal that's born from one of my sheep will now be yours. So I'm going to move them 3 days' journey away to render that impossible. That's not going to happen under my watch. Commentator continues. He says, so he puts a 3 days' distance between his flock and Jacob's flock because he doesn't trust Jacob, and he thinks that the only way that Jacob can make anything off this deal is if Jacob cheats. It seems as if Laban has won again, right? Jacob has basically ensured that he will never benefit financially from having any of those pure animals in his own flock, since all of the spotted and striped ones have been removed a safe distance away by Laban. The only animals Jacob will ever end up with are those that he's able to breed from within his own mottled flock, his own striped and spotted flock. Laban, on the other hand, has a much larger flock. You got to bear in mind, too, that the percentage of striped and spotted animals in a herd was relatively small. Why? Because Even Laban was well aware of how to breed animals, sheep and goats. And he knew that to get the purest, you had to breed the purest. Anybody here remember back in biology class doing the Punnett squares in genetics, where you have to match up all the alleles and you mix this with this and you get this and you mix it? They were aware of something of that. Even back in Laban's day, because they knew that if I breed a white and a white, I'm going to get a white. If I breed a brown with a brown, I'm going to get a brown. What happens when you breed a brown with a white? Well, all bets are off. They might have both traits, right? So they knew this. And Laban was convinced that all Jacob will ever have is striped and spotted ones, and all I'll ever have are the purest ones. And how'd that work out for Laban? Well, again, Jacob knows something that Laban doesn't, or at least he thinks he does. According to ancient tribal legal provisions that govern this deal that Laban and Jacob had made, we need to understand that not only could Jacob not have any pure animals in his flock, they would immediately be repossessed, taken away. The same thing was true in this bilateral agreement. The same thing would have been true of any spotted animals that might show up in Laban's flock. Let's say they made a mistake and they allowed a white and a brown to breed and they had a spotted or speckled offspring. That would immediately go to Jacob's flock. The agreement was that these two flocks be ever separated. Always, right? So that's important to remember going in. Let's resume reading at verse 37, and you'll see where this becomes quite interesting. Then Jacob took fresh rods of poplar and almond and plane trees, and he peeled white stripes in them, exposing the white which was in the rods. He set the rods, which he had peeled in front of the flocks in the gutters, even in the watering troughs, where the flocks came to drink, and they mated when they came to drink. So the flocks mated by the rods, and the flocks brought forth striped, speckled, and spotted. Jacob separated the lambs. He made the flocks face toward the striped and all the black in the flock of Laban. And he put his own herds apart and did not put them with Laban's flock. In other words, per the agreement, Jacob was adding to and separating his own flock from what remained of Laban's pristine flock. Moreover, whenever the stronger of the flock were mating, Jacob would place the rods in the side of the flock in the gutters so that they might mate by the rods. But when the flock was feeble, he did not put them in. So the feebler were Laban's and the stronger Jacob's. So the man, that's Jacob, became exceedingly prosperous and had large flocks and female and male servants and camels and donkeys. Now, does this work? Can you, if you have a flock of all pure white or brown animals and you strip wooden rods and lay them on the ground because they see these multicolored pieces of wood, would that somehow have an effect on the offspring? No. It's obvious that neither Laban nor Jacob nor anyone in that time understood what we now understand about genetics. They had an idea, yes, as I said, but they really didn't understand. There was a kind of urban legend or a myth that, kind of like a wives' tale, an old wives' tale, that if you stripped wood of its bark and left it kind of in a mottled sort of fashion and put that in front of mating animals, that their offspring would reflect the thing that they saw, right? This was not just something common in Jacob's culture. This is something that has actually found its way to Appalachia. There are still people in the hills of Virginia, West Virginia, Kentucky, who believe things like this. They believe that, I remember having one of my cousins explain to me that the reason she was born with red hair is because in the last trimester of her mother's pregnancy, a cardinal had begun visiting the house. And her mother said from that point forward, this child will be a red-headed child. And so it happened, because it was the cardinal. You've probably heard things like that. You know, there are all kinds of old wives' tales like that. I know a lot of the Native American people in this country have similar sorts of ways of naming their own children based upon things that they see, things that are important or considered important at the time of their birth. But it's still wrong. There's no scientific basis for that at all. As Derek Kidner pointed out, in displaying the striped rods at breeding time, Jacob was acting on the common belief that a vivid sight during pregnancy or conception would leave its mark on the embryo of the animal. But again, it's just a superstition. But we still have to ask, why was it then that Jacob's flock, or Laban's flock, began to produce striped and spotted animals? It's a what?
Miracle.
It's a miracle. Absolutely, it's a miracle. Now, Jacob thought he was a smart guy, right? Jacob thought that it was probably his genius in terms of his animal husbandry, his superior knowledge about such things. He probably thought that what he had done worked. At least we might get that impression. He may have thought that he finally got one over on Laban through his own efforts. Now, there might have been a small kernel of that in Jacob's mind, but we're going to see in the next chapter that while the animals were mating, Jacob actually had a dream in which God assured him that everything that was happening was according to his providential plan. As for Laban, the very thing that he had feared, namely that Jacob would find a way to cheat him out of his wealth, this seemed to have happened. In Laban's mind, there's no way that this could have happened without Jacob cheating. It must be that at night he's snuck these animals in. It must be that he is, in fact, breeding these two different colors of animals. Some way, somehow, Jacob is cheating. And how do we know that that's probably on Laban's mind? Well, in verses 1 and 2 of the next chapter, we read this. Now Jacob heard the words of Laban's sons, saying, Jacob has taken away all that was our father's, and from what belonged to our father, he has made all his wealth. Jacob saw the attitude of Laban, and behold, it was not friendly toward him as formerly. Laban was angry. Laban felt deceived. Laban felt as though he had been cheated. Although Laban could never prove that Jacob had cheated him, he probably went to his grave thinking that that had been the case. Little did he know that God, as he always is, was superintending the whole thing. Now, why was God interested in superintending this particular thing? Anybody know? Is God really in that level of detail? Is he really concerned about what kind of animals are being produced in one flock or another? Is he really going to bother with this agreement that was made between Jacob and Laban? Yes. Yes. Did you hear that? It had to be above board. It had to happen this way. In spite of Jacob's efforts to take care of it himself, in spite of Laban's suspicions and Laban's making sure in his own mind that this would never happen, that Jacob would never thrive, that it would be Laban himself who thrived, God was going to make good on his promise. His promise to who? To Abraham. Remember, we've already been told that the blessing was given to Abraham. The promise was given to Abraham that his spiritual seed would number as the stars in the heaven, the sands on the seashore, that through Isaac his seed would be called, that is, singular seed, the Lord Jesus Christ. He has promised that along the way, Abraham's family would always prosper physically, materially, as a sign of God's abiding favor on the whole family. God has made this promise, and it's not going to be thwarted by Jacob. It's not going to be thwarted by Laban. It's not going to be thwarted by anybody. God is going to make good on his promise, even if he has to have a miracle intervention in providing from a pure flock animals that would then be taken to populate Jacob's flock. So who comes out on top? Jacob comes out on top. Why? Because he's a good animal breeder? No, because God is a good and faithful God. That's the takeaway. God is going to do what God does in spite of you. God is going to do what he has promised to do in spite of you, in spite of your mistakes, in spite of your sins, in spite of anything that you think yourself capable of doing to handle things on your own. God is going to do what God does. Why? Because he has decreed it. And whatever he has decreed will come to pass. Infallibly. Without exception. Just as an aside here, you'll notice that Moses tells us that in addition to being blessed with large flocks and male and female servants, Jacob was also blessed with camels and donkeys. Now, the donkey part we can get. Donkeys were fairly prevalent in Jacob's day. It's the camel thing that's really interesting. And this is, again, something that you wouldn't know unless you went and did some research on the actual history and anthropological setting. What you don't realize, perhaps, is that camels during this particular day were not yet domesticated. They were domesticated, but only by the wealthiest of the wealthy, who saw their potential as being beasts of burden. All that to say that if you had a camel, it was the equivalent of today having a Bentley or a Rolls Royce. Because only the wealthiest could afford to keep camels and to use camels in this way. I thought that was a really fascinating thing. To say that Jacob was blessed is an understatement. He was blessed with wealth beyond imagination. Now, the application here is fairly straightforward. We would do well to remember that in any and all circumstances, God has, God is, and God will always be in sovereign control of every molecule in his created realm. Do you believe that? No, you don't. How do I know that? Because I obviously don't believe it either. Well, what am I saying? Am I actually saying that I don't believe in the absolute sovereignty of God? I'm saying that I don't practically believe it. I believe it intellectually. I believe it with every fiber of my being as far as my physical makeup. But this is something that is very slow making its way from here to here. How do I know that? Because if we really believed it here, we would not worry about another single thing. Think about that for just a minute. Before you just, you know, I'm going to say again in the next hour, talk is cheap. And we all talk a good game when it comes to our Christian experience, when it comes to our profession of faith. But talk is cheap. We can say all day long, oh, I believe in the absolute sovereignty of God. Well, okay, brother, sister, how can I pray for you? Well, I'm just so worried about my children. I'm just so worried about fill in the blank. If you can put anything in that blank, you don't trust in the absolute sovereignty of God. Well, Pastor, that's a problem. It is, and it's a problem I hope we all work on from this point forward. I hope it's a problem that we ask the Lord routinely, Lord, help me to trust you more. Lord, help me to see that you are who you say you are. And oh, by the way, I am who you say that I am. That should be the most frightening thing. And yet you love me. And you do provide for me. And the things that you do are beyond figuring out. Deuteronomy 29:29, the secret things belong to the Lord. They will always belong to the Lord. Ours is not to question why. Ours is but to do and die. Are you placing your entire trust in a sovereign God? Or are you trying to take matters into your own hands? Do you insist that life is sometimes unfair, that life is sometimes unjust? And you know, one of the most telling things that has convinced me of the need that we all have to either regain or gain a sense of God's absolute sovereignty and then align ourselves underneath that. One of the most telling things happened in November of 2020. Remember going to bed the night of November 3rd, 2020, thinking that Donald Trump was going to be our president for another 4 years, only to find out that at 3 a.m., massive amounts of votes for the other guy began coming in, and before the morning news was even aired, Joe Biden had won the presidency. People lost their minds, including professing believers. I want you to think about that. Some of you might be in this room right now. You lost your minds. You can't believe. How dare those other people take it upon themselves to cheat? They cheated us out of the one that we wanted to be president. Really? Are you that naive? Are you that out of touch with the absolute sovereignty of God to not even know the most fundamental thing about Him, which is that He establishes kings and He takes kings down? And as Proverbs 16 says, man may make plans, but God directs his steps. Are you so spiritually and biblically illiterate, no offense, that you think man is capable of doing something that thwarted God's plan? Folks, I'm telling you right now, I know people who believe that Donald Trump is God's man. He's not. Obviously. At least not for this time. Not at this moment. Much better, is it not, to resign ourselves to the sovereignty of a thrice holy God who knows exactly what you and I need, when we need it, how we need it, why we need it. Much better to trust in a sovereign God who does what He does for one reason only, and that's to bring Himself glory. And oh, by the way, it's better for you. Well, it sure doesn't feel better. Well, you're not God. Now, let me just say this as well. I shouldn't have to say this, but I will say this. Yes, be a responsible citizen. Campaign, vote, cheerlead, you know, the most godly candidate that you can perceive of that's running in the race. Yes. Be actively involved. That's part of being a good citizen. That's part of exercising good stewardship where God has placed us. I'm not saying anything about that. I'm just saying that whatever the results are, whenever those results come in, don't bemoan the providence of a sovereign God. You know what that's the equivalent of? It's the equivalent of looking up at God and saying, well, God, you missed that one. These cheaters, man, they hoodwinked you, didn't they, God? Really? Do we think that little of God? I think it's a good question to ask. Before you get wrapped around the axle about anything in this entire created realm, what should your first question be? Lord, what are you trying to teach me through this act of divine providence? And when I say biblically and spiritually illiterate, it's not really an insult, it's not an ad hominem attack on anyone in this room. It's just that, are we not told throughout the Scriptures? One of the reasons we're doing this Old Testament study is so that we can see time and time and time and time again where God does things that make absolutely no sense until they do. God's dealings in the affairs of humanity are often perplexing. But in the Scriptures, we have an entire complete record of the reality that whatever He ordains is right. And not only that, we have the assurance that one day we will all be vindicated, that every wrong will be corrected, that we'll be removed finally from the presence of sin itself and able to worship Him in purity, in truth, for eternity. It's just not now. It just hasn't happened now. Do not think for one minute that man is capable of getting something over on God. And I say that for all of our benefit. Think how much better you'll sleep at night when you can lay your head down and say, whatever happened this day, good, bad, or indifferent, happened because you love me. And you've got something in store for me. And though I can't see it right now, you will make good on your promises. I believe that we would all do well to remember. You know, we sometimes sing a song, and in that song we sing, behind a frowning providence, He hides a smiling face. Some of us, we've sung that song for years and don't really know what that means. What that means is that we need to look to Him, not at our circumstances, not at our temporal life, but look at Him as the author and finisher of our faith. what might seem like a complete disaster, what might seem to us to be unfair, unjust, unwise, etc., is simply God's working all things out for our good and for His glory. Well, in our next study, we'll see that Jacob's faith actually did grow as he's able to acknowledge that every blessing he had received was from God. And not only that, but God had appeared to him in yet another dream in which he explains everything that was happening and everything that would happen.